Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome to UBS On Air for another edition of the How Should I Be Positioned podcast. As you know, on this podcast, we do like to showcase the UBS House View recommendations versus those of our colleagues from partner asset manager firms. We also touch on timely macro developments and discuss how global markets and asset classes are being impacted. So let's get started with today's face-off. Joining us today from UBS is Jason Dreho. Jason is the head of asset allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. And from the partner side, excited to welcome back to UBS On Air, Richard Bernstein, the Chief Executive Officer, Chief Investment Officer of Richard Bernstein Advisors, or RBA. So Jason and Rich, it's great to be with you both. I think back to when the three of us were last on the line together. It was back in January. We were in our studios, 20th floor of 1285 6th Avenue in Midtown. Different times indeed, but it's great to be back with you both today and looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you, Rich, for joining us today.
So I know there's a lot of ground that we want to cover during our time together today. And I know at this point we have some clarity in terms of the makeup of the U.S. government heading into 2021. We've heard about some exciting and encouraging developments on the COVID-19 vaccine front. So with those items in mind, Rich, what are your expectations for the trajectory of the U.S. economy in 2021?
Well, Dan, you know, I think if you're just talking trajectory and you're not talking absolute numbers, I think it's relatively straightforward. I think if somebody wants to put a decimal point on a forecast, I think that's virtually impossible right now. So I the reason I say that is that, you know, hopefully as we go through 2021, the pandemic will subside, whether that's naturally or, you know, via a vaccine or something. And so comparisons versus 2020 are going to be relatively easy. And so I think one should expect the economy, just overall in broad sweeping terms, the economy in 2021 is going to be healthier, if I can use that term, healthier than 2020. I don't think that's hugely insightful, but I think that simplistic way of looking at the world can be very helpful.
Well, I think Rich is absolutely right that the actual GDP number next year is really hard to predict. You know, there's a wide range of forecasts, and in some ways it gets a little bit less given the low base we're going to be right on year over year. What I focus on is the fact that we're going to have two attributes that tend to be, you know, good for, you know, for risk assets. The first is that ultimately growth will be above the kind of long-term trend. In the U.S., you know, trend is around 2%, so we should easily kind of clear that hurdle. The question is how much? And then the second thing is growth is likely to accelerate as we go throughout the year, at least from the start of the year until, you know, in the middle of the year. And the reason being is that, you know, we're starting in some way off a bit of a slow foot, given the rising number of cases in the U.S. Some restrictions have been put into place. So we're likely to see a bit of a soft patch in growth in the U.S. as we kind of go into Iran and the start of the year. But as that hopefully abates, as the pandemic abates, then we should see acceleration of growth. So that combination of above trend growth and accelerating growth has historically been kind of the sweet spot for risk assets. So that's how I think of it, is that, you know, those attributes as opposed to the exact number itself.
To that point, Rich, if the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic begin to subside in 2021 as the vaccines begin rolling out and become distributed on a wider scale across the country, how might that translate to performance of risk assets? And I'm also curious, Rich, your vantage point in terms of how much good news is already priced into markets as of today.
Dan, I think the answer to your question is it kind of depends on how you define risk assets. And I think, like, a lot of people would say that stocks are risk assets. But, you know, within the stock market right now, you've got this, I would argue, gigantic dichotomy between sort of FANG and tech and innovation and disruption and the rest of the stock market. So, you know, I think that if we see a broader, if we see broader growth in the U.S. economy in 2021, I think we should expect the stock market leadership to broaden as well. And you know, so, you know, risk assets, if you're thinking risk assets as FANG, it might not do very well. If you're thinking risk assets as, you know, value, small caps, cyclicals, industrials, things like that, you might do very well. Same thing that if you move away from treasuries and you go to riskier bonds, if you go outside the United States, you know, all these kind of things could be better, but it's going to depend on what your position is now and what your definition is of a risk asset. I think the important, to summarize what I'm trying to say here, I think that as we look at 2021, we should expect leadership to change in a broad range of asset classes.
I think if you look at November, it's a nice kind of microcosm for what's happened for the whole year. A lot of news obviously began with the election, then positive news on the vaccine, but also kind of ending with rising COVID cases. But when we saw the vaccine news for Pfizer come out, and this was on early Monday morning on November 9th, from that time period up until through yesterday, we saw a very significant rotation in kind of sector performance within the S&P 500. So the overall index was up around 3.5% since that time period. But the energy sector was up over 30%. Financials were up 14%. Industrials, 9%. Whereas tech was, around 1%, basically close to flat. Those are dramatic performance differences, that kind of swung based on the news of the economy kind of normalized. And so that can sound like really significant outperformance. But if you then kind of pull back, not just from November, but for the full year, or even go back a few years, it's almost like, the reversal in outperformance we've seen in some of these sectors the past few weeks barely makes a dent into the underperformance they've had over the past few years. So this kind of broad rotation, as Rich described, I think is something that is likely to continue. But if you just look at other, kind of recessions and then recovery periods, in the 1 to 2 to up to 3 years kind of in that initial recovery phase, you look at, say, small caps versus large caps, they will outperform by the range of like 30, 40, 50%. And that's been consistent from the early 90s to early 2000s to after the great financial crisis. So if you take that as a playbook, that would suggest there's a lot of scope for continued rotation. So I think it's less a little bit next year about, kind of overall market level rallying a lot as opposed to being in the right sectors, the right styles, and even to some extent the right regions, which given how well the U.S. has performed, I think that you could see sort of a broadening out to other regions, especially say in emerging markets, as this sort of this kind of catch-up trade materializes, again, hopefully, again, predicated on the pandemic kind of getting under control globally.
Curious, Rich, to get your thoughts on earnings growth heading into the new year. What are your expectations there?
Yeah, so, Dan, I think this is one of the more interesting, and I would actually say almost easier factors for investors to forecast, but yet there's actually been remarkably little discussion about this. And what I mean by that is that earnings growth next year could explode on the upside, right? The S&P 500 could easily see earnings growth of 20-25%, but really could see growth of 50-75-100% growth. Now, why would that be? Well, simply because the base year 2020 is so depressed because of the pandemic. And so you're going to have very easy comparisons. Again, maybe the pandemic gets worse. I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios you could play out, but let's assume that the pandemic subsides for any number of different reasons. 2021 earnings growth is going to be tremendous off of the 2020 base. Now, when I say that, people very often come back and say, oh, well, it's just easy comparisons. Yeah, but that's true, of course, but it's important to remember that every cycle begins with easy comparisons. You can't start a cycle with hard comparisons. So the notion that we have easy comparisons in the base year is very encouraging for earnings growth in 2021, maybe even for 2022. It's hard to say. But I think, if you're looking for that cyclical rotation in 2021, that's basically what you're predicating it on, is tremendous earnings growth. Now, when I also say that, sometimes people come back and they say, oh, but you don't understand, the secular growers, the FANG stocks, the secular growers, are still going to be growing. Well, that's true, but you have to remember that this is kind of called relative earnings. It's an old-fashioned concept, and relative earnings, when cycles heat up, favor cyclicals. Yes, the secular growers may be growing 20 or 30%, but the cyclical growers will be growing 50, 100, 200, 300, 400% and will make the 15, 20, 25% grower look like nothing, especially given the valuation of those companies today. So it's a very important point, and I think a very, very a critical point relative to the way people are positioned to think about earnings growth in 2021 and how it could really explode on the upside depending on one's view of the pandemic.
Our official forecast is 26% earnings growth for next year. So in line with what you started with, but then you talked about explode to the upside of 30, 50, 70, even 100%. I'd almost sort of push back that as well as mathematically. Is that achievable when we look at, say, the tech sector, which is their earnings this year have held up pretty well. A lot of growth stocks have held up pretty well. So in contrast to the idea of easy comp, in fact, it's not necessarily an easy comp for those companies, and given how large they are in terms of the earnings pool, you need truly explosive growth in some of the sectors like energy or financials, which, you know, energy is now 2% of the index. So mathematically, that's like what's I mean, yes, it can be, you know, an upside scenario, but like really what's kind of, you know, best case scenario? Like is it 50% actually really mathematically plausible?
Right. Jason, excellent point. I mean, yes, the math is kind of going against my hyperbolic statements. I will readily admit that, and I do tend to speak in hyperbole. But I think the important point is not so much that I get this forecast right, but that earnings really could, you know, double or triple or more in some of these very depressed cyclical sectors. So, yes, the math may make it impossible to get 50% or 75% earnings growth. But I think, you know, underneath that, you could have these monster earnings growth rates in some of the deeper cyclical sectors. And even if you go to small cap cyclicals, you could have tremendous growth rates there. You know, but you're absolutely correct in terms of, you know, will the index itself put up those kind of numbers? You're right. My hyperbolic statement is probably hyperbolic.
I'm not opposed to hyperbole by any stretch, but that leads me to maybe another follow-on question. This kind of gets into not to the earnings, but the actual, like, you know, returns, because typically, you know, you get valuations expand some in a recession because the market anticipates higher earnings. Now we're going to get that earnings growth next year. If, I guess, and the question is, like, what happens to the multiple? Because if the multiple doesn't really contract very much, then we're talking about a really significant upside for equities next year. So what's your kind of expectation then how the multiple would behave in this environment?
Yeah, I would temper my enthusiasm for the overall market a little bit based on what you said, because I think our expectation is that interest rates will go up. And if interest rates go up, then, you know, typically multiples would compress. So even though the earnings growth of some of these companies may be tremendous, we have to remember they're probably going to be on shrinking multiples through time. Now, of course, the part of what I'm arguing underneath it, and Jason, if this is where you're going to, you're absolutely correct, is that the market may not do a whole lot, but the rotation within the market could be very exciting. And that would kind of be, if you think about post 2000, when post-tech bubble, where we had the lost decade in equities, And so the equity market really didn't do much of anything. It was down a little bit for the decade, if I'm not mistaken. But within that, you had tremendous rotations, and you could make a lot of money if you were in the right segments of the global equity markets. That's kind of what we're looking for, but probably on a smaller scale.
When we think about sort of base case scenarios, and to me, like when I think about then the upside scenario and downside scenario, for equities, it feels like the risk reward skew is more to the upside, because you could get, you know, this earnings growth. I think, you know, rates could rise a little bit, but, you know, probably in a somewhat contained fashion. If we have the growth outlook that I mentioned, you know, earlier of accelerating above trend growth with still a very accommodative monetary policy, that's up for a very kind of favorable environment for equities to do well. But not to that open, but I think it's, you know, hearing what you know, which about an earnings front, there's a lot of sort of boxes being checked where, you know, you don't want to get too enthusiastic, but there's definitely, I think, kind of the skew to me, you know, is kind of tilting towards equities having another really strong year next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Something else I want to bring up. I know investors are constantly on the hunt for yield, so maybe we can spend a few moments just touching on the fixed income side of things. And Rich, with bond yields so low, from your vantage point, where are good opportunities within fixed income, and how should investors think about fixed income, that kind of role in a portfolio at this time?
Right. Well, Dan, you know, part of our story is we think that interest rates are going to go up, as I mentioned before. So, you know, if one's looking for income and interest rates go up, one has to accept a negative total return. I'm not sure everybody's going to be able to stomach that type of environment. And so I think to some extent, I don't want to over-dramatize this. I think there's lots of drama when people talk about interest rates going up and everything. And I don't want to overdo it by any means. But I think the combination of potential for rising rates, the potential for maybe weaker dollar, the potential for changes in tax policy, I think argue for a change in the way one thinks about income overall. And you know, I think individual investors may increasingly have to think of income the way some institutional investors do. As I'm sure many of the listeners on this call know, foundations have to spend 5% of their corpus every year to maintain their tax-free status. And so what they do is they look for income, if you will, through basically appreciation of the corpus of the portfolio through time. I kind of think that's the way that individuals should increasingly think of income, not as getting a dividend, not as getting a coupon, but rather as selling a proportion of their corpus every year along with a smaller coupon or a smaller dividend. And I think that becomes very, very important if you think that rates are going up, if you think inflation may be going up, all those kind of things, because it's going to be very difficult for a pure income-oriented investor to keep up with inflation. Even if, I'm not suggesting we're seeing 1970s-type inflation. Don't misunderstand the point at all. But if the consensus right now is for, I don't know, 1% to 2% inflation, if it turns out to be 3% inflation, the markets may have trouble stomaching that. And that could be very difficult for a kind of an old-fashioned income-oriented investor. So I think, you know, look, you can think about non-U.S. income. You can think about riskier bonds. There's lots of different ways to skin the income cat. But I think in general, you know, if we are entering, and some people argue that we are entering some different secular period for fixed income. If that's true, I think income-oriented investors have to become more creative in the way they think of the way to derive income. And there may be tax issues along with that too. It may be preferable to take capital gains. You know, things like that. That's what I think people have to start thinking about.
What about your thoughts, Jason?
So, you know, it does pose a challenge when the kind of pickings are pretty slim in the fixed income landscape, given how low yields are, both even for kind of government bonds, but, you know, for corporate credit as well. So there's a couple of things I would advise clients to think about. One is, almost like a bit of a barbell approach to fixed income. On the prospect that, you know, rates could rise a little bit next year, not dramatically so, but when yields are so low right now, given the sort of long duration of these instruments, you don't really have much cushion for, like, how much rates could rise before your total return turns negative. You know, for U.S. investment grade corporate credit, literally, if spreads stay the same, but, you know, the 10-year yield rises 20 basis points, your entire kind of return for the year could be wiped out because, you know, the yield on IG right now is less than 2%. So the idea of the barbell is kind of both very short duration, and that's why one of the preferences, you know, we have is for, like, kind of senior loans, which are a floating rate instrument. At the other end, from a portfolio diversification perspective, I think, you know, some very long duration, you know, fixed income instruments like, you know, 30-year treasuries can still provide some ballast in your portfolio. It doesn't take much decline in rates for those instruments to pay off. If rates rise, okay, you get hurt a little bit on that side, but hopefully it's rising because it's because economic conditions are better and you're more than making up for it on the equity side. But I think that's still, there's still some benefit to having that as sort of portfolio protection. And then the second point is kind of follows what Alan Richard said, just regarding being a little more creative in terms of how you think about kind of generating income. You know, whether it's looking for different asset classes, doing things such as, like, you know, writing kind of covered calls. If equities are rising, you know, there's a point where then your equity portfolio should increase. Then that means perhaps, you know, writing these kind of covered calls gives you income. And if it does get called away, well, that's okay because perhaps now you're overallocated to equities. So these are ways to kind of enhance, you know, what is against sort of a relatively meager yield. And then I think there's other things that you can look at as well. But the key is to understand, you know, the risks that you're taking. And then as you reach for yield or kind of reach that 4 or 5% kind of target, you know, there's no free lunch out there. You have to take some risk and you have to be prepared for volatility. And we've seen it this year that if you really are an income investor, you know, over time you can, you know, you can get your income stream, but you have to perhaps, you know, stomach greater price volatility. And, you know, if you look at your statements every month or every quarter, you're going to see big fluctuations. That's just going to be perhaps par for the course, you know, for income generating investors going forward.
Maybe we can spend a few moments touching on some economic trends that perhaps have emerged or even accelerated as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has been playing out over the past year. Rich, curious to get your thoughts in terms of changes that have occurred during the pandemic period that are likely to be permanent versus those maybe reverting back to pre-COVID patterns. And of any of these changes or trends, do you view these as being accelerations of existing trends that might have already been in place?
Dan, my take on this is maybe a little different from most people's. First of all, I think the correct answer is nobody really knows. You know, it's not like we go through a pandemic every day and we can look to history and decide what's going to be the human reaction subsequent to a pandemic. I don't think we know. But where I think I differ from a lot of people is I do not believe that a lot of the changes we will see, that we have seen, will stick simply because it's a preferable lifestyle. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it's going to be plain old competition in business that's going to determine how we adjust. Is it going to be identical to what it was pre-pandemic? No, of course not. Of course not. But there's lots of people guessing that, and a lot of companies have made these bold proclamations that they're never, you know, they're going to have 100% of their workforce working at home and things like that. I think it's premature to make those broad sweeping decisions because, look, let me make it kind of tangible. Let's say every UBS advisor decides they're going to work at home 100% of the time. And UBS decides they're never going to have an office again. They're never going to have a branch office again. Just going to do away with the mall and everybody's going to work at home. Okay, what happens then if Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley or you know, Raymond James or somebody else keeps their offices and people find they like going to an office. They like seeing an office. They like being with a financial advisor. They like the impression of the way the office looks and everything like that. And they like dealing and seeing and sitting across the table and being treated in a certain way, in a certain personal aspect. And UBS starts losing customers because of that. Do you think UBS is going to tell their financial advisors they can work at home? No way. No way. That's just not going to happen. It's going to be plain old competition that's going to decide how different companies ultimately deal with this. That's not going to be in the next 6 months, of course. That may not be in the next year. It may not be in the next 2 years. But I think ultimately it's going to be competitive advantage that's going to cause people to change their behavior in one form or another. Look, it could be that nobody ever wants to go to a UBS office again, and clients don't want that. Fine, then there'll be no offices. I get that. But I just don't think people know. And so what I think for people out there that are running small businesses like I am, the way you have to deal with the future is for maximum flexibility. You don't want to paint yourself into a corner, which you then regret in 2 years because the world has turned into something that we couldn't anticipate. And I think when you invest, you have to think that way too. You don't want to be dogmatic about what's going to happen because the world in 2 years will be something that we cannot envision right now. And you don't want to, as I said, paint yourself into a corner.
What about your take on this, Jason? I know the Chief Investment Office recently released the Year Ahead publication, A Year of Renewal. And within that piece, it does spend some time touching on some of the next big trends that will play out over the next decade that might have emerged or have been accelerated as a result of the pandemic. So what can you share with us there?
So first, I just think about what Rich was alluding to regarding what could be permanent versus temporary as a result of the pandemic, and what's going to be long lasting. To me, the things that were already sort of in motion, it will stay in motion, and the pandemic accelerated that. So, for example, let's call it the deglobalization or less globalization. I think that was already in play going back a few years ago because of trade tensions, and even before that. That I think will continue even after the pandemic eases. Another thing that was already a problem beforehand was different issues of kind of income inequality, not just whether it's wages, but even across the corporate sector. We're increasingly seeing sort of winner take all markets. That some firms get the lion's share of the market, and other firms increasingly get a shrinking share. That was true prior to the pandemic, and given how there's been very clear differentiation between winners and losers in the pandemic, then that's a trend that is likely to continue. Another thing is the rise of populism as an offset of that will probably continue. So these are trends that began before the pandemic. I think those ones are likely to continue. I think the things that are harder to call is whether it's kind of working from home, working from the office. I think that's true. The consumer patterns. Will people not go to movie theaters again after this? I think that's a much harder call to make. Perhaps I'm just speaking for my own personal preferences, but I'm looking forward to being able to travel kind of somewhat unconstrained again, going to concerts. So I think a lot of things that have been put on hold, they may kind of bounce back pretty quickly, but that's kind of an open question. just in terms of the long-term trends and themes that we did highlight in the report, a lot of them were sometimes in place before, but we think about, you know, the next decade ahead, which ones are like to materialize. It kind of ties back into the initial conversation about, you know, the rotation and what's worked well this year, and you know, the FANG stocks have done very well recently. It's kind of more about kind of broadening out from those areas of technology, specifically to areas that leverage technology in different ways, whether that's, you know, fintech, health tech, green tech. You know, these are kind of some of the ideas that we kind of touch on in that report. You know, more of other areas and other businesses leveraging the technology as opposed to the technology sector per se, which, again, these are trends that were in place to some extent pre-pandemic, to varying degrees they've been accelerated, and that's going to continue, I think, for the next decade.
Thank you, Jason. Well, time will tell how some of these trends play out. I know we're beginning to come to the end of our time together today. There is a lot of other topics we can touch on. Maybe because it is topical, we can spend a few moments just talking about monetary and fiscal policy. Rich, will they be fundamentally different over the next 5 to 10 years compared to the past decade from your vantage point?
You know, I think the time horizon you gave is an interesting time horizon, 5 to 10 years. I think that the key to your answer is whether foreigners, non-U.S. investors, remain net sellers of treasuries. Very recently, in the last year, foreigners have become net sellers of treasuries. And that's very important for monetary and fiscal policy because, to a certain extent, it handcuffs the United States. You know, we relied very heavily on having a rich uncle kind of fund our deficits, fund our growth, fund our spending. And if foreigners become net sellers of treasuries or remain net sellers of treasuries, we can't do that. What it means is we either have to monetize the debt, meaning the Fed buys everything, the Treasury prints dollars, or we have to start raising taxes and pay for it ourselves. So those have different implications for investing, and my guess is it's not all one or the other. It's some cocktail of the two. But I think if we find, look, if we come back here in 2 years and we find that non-U.S. investors are net buyers of treasuries, you know, my concerns are unfounded. But if the recent trend continues, that says that monetary and fiscal policy will be handcuffed to a certain extent, because you're going to need to spend on higher multiplier investments. Maybe they'll actually do something like infrastructure. Gee, that would be amazing. And things like that, because you're going to have to overwhelm the negative effect of an increase in taxes. So, you know, little things like that. You're going to have to, well, monetary policy and, you know, well, we have to trash the dollar, so to speak, not as dramatic as I just made it out to be, but we have to depreciate the dollar is probably a better way to say it. But we have to depreciate the dollar to accommodate the Fed buying more and more debt through time. Those are the type of issues that I think that financial advisors have to think about if you're looking at a 3, 5, 10 year time frame for monetary and fiscal policy. It's going to hinge, I think, it's going to hinge on that one issue as to whether non-U.S. investors are net sellers of treasuries. And if that continues, it means that we lose a major funding source for our debt, for our deficits, and for our growth. And so we have to consider that very carefully.
Jason, what about your thoughts on the future of both monetary and fiscal policy?
So I approach the problem in a little bit of a different way. If we can just set the context, we look back at the past decade of the financial crisis. If we have two levers to pull, one is monetary, one is fiscal. By all accounts, it was, you know, very significant monetary policy, certainly by the Fed, not even more significant in the pandemic era, but that was definitely the levers that were being pulled. There wasn't significant fiscal, you know, expansion in the U.S. for much of the past decade. If you go to Europe, you know, they had sovereign debt crises where the advice given to some governments was actually to, like, you know, cut spending. Even in the U.K., they cut spending early on. So they went in the opposite, you know, kind of direction. So it was very much a, you know, monetary policy was driving everything. We weren't getting much from fiscal for the past decade. And prior to the pandemic, you know, the, you know, economist, market strategist was, when the next recession comes, monetary policy is going to be less effective given where, you know, rates are as a starting point going into the recession. Therefore, fiscal policy will have to do the heavy lifting. So the good news, if there is a good news from the pandemic, is that we've seen very substantial fiscal support in the U.S. and in other countries around the world to get us through the past 9 months. The question is whether that will continue or we kind of revert back to relatively kind of lean fiscal policy. And it's again, monetary policy has to do the bulk of the lifting by staying very accommodative. I'm hopeful that it's fiscal policy, whether it's on infrastructure, targeted investment, things that would actually improve long-term productivity. That could happen not just in the U.S., but globally. But that's a political decision more than an economics decision. And I think, given the current state of the political environment in the U.S., but I think this applies to some other countries as well in Europe. I think I'm a little, maybe pessimistic or not as optimistic as I'd like that that's going to happen. So I think within, in the next few years, it's probably going to stay similar to what it was. But hopefully, we'd actually maybe get some sort of real change on the fiscal side. I'd be less worried about foreign buyers about, U.S. interest rates or U.S. treasuries, because I think ultimately what you have then is what the Fed has done this year. It's pretty much absorbed the entire additional supply of treasuries, even though they don't directly buy from the government, but that net effect has happened. So you get monetary and fiscal policy to some extent working in conjunction, supportive to achieving sort of long-term objectives. That could happen, but I think we have to be kind of skeptical until we actually see it happening.
One final question. We'll treat this as a lightning round, and Jason will provide our guest, Rich, with the final word. So I'll ask you one item we haven't covered yet that remains a top concern, and what would get you more positive at this time?
Well, the more positive one, I think, is easy. If we get, the vaccine starts to be rolled out soon, and it kind of exceeds expectations how quickly people are able to get it, and it's proven to be very effective. Maybe by the February, March timeline, we could start to see a really precipitous decline in the number of cases. And if that happens, then we're setting up for that kind of bull case scenario that we just discussed, earlier. In terms of the risks, I think it's kind of almost the opposite of that. If it turns out, the vaccine or the pandemic didn't really get under control to the way, we expect, I think then, it's negative psychologically and individually how we live our lives. Obviously, it's then negative for the economy. The markets are really very much kind of pricing in that scenario. So I know we touched on it, but I think we have sort of touched on that perhaps not going as well as it could. I think it's low risk, but I think it's something that no one is really kind of, or very few people are really kind of positioned for at this point in time.
Thank you, Jason. And then, Rich, same set of questions. One item we haven't covered that remains a top concern for you and maybe something that would get you more positive at this time.
I don't think there's necessarily a top concern for the immediate future. I'm not sanguine on what's going on. I mean, Jason outlined the risks related to COVID and things like that and the uncertainty related to that. I think my concerns are longer term. I think that one has to realize to some extent that globalization is contracting. You could argue whether that's good or bad, whether it should happen or should not happen. That's not my day job. But the reality is it's starting to contract, and globalization through history has acted like an accordion. It expands and contracts through time. And I think investors, although I think there are tremendous opportunities outside the United States right now in terms of equity markets, I think the opportunities outside the United States may be equal, if not better, to the opportunities in the United States. But I think longer term, as we some of the questions you posed, Dan, were 5 to 10 years. I think as you look out 5 to 10 years, one has to try to assess what it means to have a contracting globalization, and the differences that makes, and what that means to you, to your portfolio, and I we could have a whole separate conference call on that one, but I think that's my main concern is that most investors are not thinking longer term. They're not incented to think long term these days. And therefore, that's a longer term risk that's sitting out there. But in the near term, look, barring an acceleration of the pandemic, to where it gets to, unimaginative levels, I think one should err on the side of optimism, not blind optimism, but still on the side of optimism.
Well, Rich and Jason, you've been very generous with your time today. Greatly appreciate all of the ground that you've covered with our listeners, a lot of unique and valuable insights. I'm sure the conversation will continue well into 2021, so look forward to having you both join us on the podcast again. But thank you for joining us on today's edition of How Should I Be Positioned?
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Absolutely. And again, today we have been joined by Jason Dreho, the head of Asset Allocation Americas with the Chief Investment Office from UBS, as well as by Richard Bernstein, the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer of Richard Bernstein Advisors, RBA. From UBS On Air Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.